A new option is now available for Honolulu's homeless population to get health care. A center in Chinatown is providing free, non-emergency health care services. The conversation, Ryan Finnerty was on hand for the opening ceremony of the Joint Outreach Center and brought back this report.
A traditional lion dance marked the official opening of the Joint Outreach Center, located next to the downtown police substation on Hotel Street. Leaders from government, healthcare, and the nonprofit communities gathered to mark its opening. The center is a no-cost healthcare option for homeless residents in Honolulu's urban core. As Honolulu's homeless population has increased, so has the demand for medical services. They often end up transported by ambulance to the emergency room for minor problems, creating runaway costs and overburdening hospitals. The center hopes to reduce that trend by coordinating efforts of police, outreach workers, and volunteer healthcare providers. Honolulu Mayor Kirk Caldwell says the new approach is the type of change the city needs.
Today is about getting services to people that need it the most, so that they actually are taken care of here in Chinatown, so they don't end up at Queens in the emergency room, they don't end up in our ambulances being delivered there, eating up valuable resources and capital that could be devoted to other things. And it took a group of people to step up and say, let's work together. And yes, it requires an administration that is about innovation. It's not afraid about change, whether it be bulb outs or bike lanes or rail or electric buses or fixing up Ala Moana or these other things. It's about planning for a better future and not being afraid of change. And this is about that too. A lot of these folks that we find that don't have homes have serious, serious medical issues, whether it be they have an infection or they have a mental challenge, a mental illness challenge, or an addiction to drugs or alcohol. They can walk into this center and get assistance from these outreach workers and HPD. Some folks say that I'm too harsh. We have this term called compassionate disruption, where we tell folks who don't have a home that you cannot be in a park overnight. You can't occupy a sidewalk and force pedestrians into the street. But it is about compassion too, and we are building units, buying units, and housing people. And this is about compassion. It's about helping people who need help immediately in the heart of Chinatown, saying, come here and get treatment.
Honolulu Police Chief Susan Ballard says the program is an important step toward addressing the city's homeless crisis, but cautions that it's only a start.
The main thing is that we're going to take a chance. Our administration is about taking risks, and we're going to step forward, and we're going to do what the police department, along with the city, needs to do to solve the problems that are here, not only in Chinatown, but throughout this island. So this help center is a coordinated effort through a lot of different agencies. It's not just HPD. We're just a very minor part of this. And as we move forward, we're asking all the communities to support this, and we're asking also the businesses to support as well. Because you folks, the businesses, the private businesses, you guys are the ones that know how to make things work. Government, we take too long to get stuff done, but we're gonna support you. But we need the businesses and we need the community to push this forward, and we'll be behind you and we will help you out wherever we can. And this location, since it's been open for the last 2.5 months informally, we have helped over 200 of the homeless people who are in this area. Done wound care. We've gotten them prescription refills, which is very important. We've also been able to get people housing. We've been able to get people into drug treatment. And it's one person at a time. It's not going to be overnight. What happened out here, what's happening across the United States, did not happen overnight. And so we have to start somewhere. And one person at a time is where we're going to start. And I agree wholeheartedly with the mayor, is that it is extremely inhumane to ask or have anyone to live out in the streets. That's not the way the human beings live. We need to get them into housing. We need to get them into permanent housing. I went on a ride along a couple days ago with one of the Chinatown officers down here. Bless his heart, he let me ride in his car and he put up with me while I was in there. But we went to River Street. We went to the homeless encampment over there. We had to make them move off the sidewalk because they were blocking the sidewalk. I talked to a couple of the people who were living there, the residences, for lack of a better term. And one of them was this nice couple. And they said they've been trying to get into housing, but they cannot because they're married. Well, if we need to have housing for married couples, that's what we need to do. There was another person who said they can't get in because the rules said they can't smoke and they can't drink. Well, if we need to develop a housing so that people can smoke and they can have reasonable amounts of alcohol, let's do that. And at the same time, get them services to move them into permanent housing. But we've got to get them off the streets one step at a time.
One of the nonprofit partners in the Joint Outreach Center is the recently formed Hawaii Homeless Healthcare Hui, or H4. Medical professionals with H4 will be providing healthcare services at the center for free. Emergency medicine doctor Josh Green is one of them. He's the founder of H4 and heads its board of directors. He also represents Hawaii Island on the state senate and is a Democratic candidate for lieutenant governor.
When an ER patient is suffering, when a homeless individual is suffering, and they can't get control of their lives, usually what happens is a conflict occurs, the medics are called, a $1,000 bill ensues after a four-hour experience with the police officers. Maybe there's violence. Maybe they've suffered so greatly they've hurt themselves. And after that ambulance spends $1,000 and takes them to Queens, where 30% of all of the ER visits at Queens are now homeless individuals, many hours are spent with that staff, and that individual will finally get care for several thousands of dollars seeing an ER physician like me. Now we're at $3,000 or $4,000 have been spent. Maybe they stay for a long time at the ER because there's just nowhere to go. And then tens of thousands of dollars have been spent, and the individual may not have gotten any better. And this happens day in and day out.
H4's executive director, Andy Mountainday, hopes the new service will help struggling residents and the community at large.
We are also working with HPD to alleviate the time it takes to medically clear homeless individuals at the ER. We hope officers will spend only 1 hour at the Joint Outreach Center versus several hours in the ER. This will allow officers more time to patrol the street, and hopefully that's a benefit to the community.
Medical services at the center will be available to any member of the public on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 1 to 8 p.m. From Chinatown, I'm Ryan Finnerty for The Conversation.
You can find more details about the Joint Outreach Center and the services available there on our website. Just look for The Conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. And for one longtime observer in Chinatown, a bad situation is only getting worse. Chulan Schubert Kwok is the president of the Chinatown Community and Business Association and a member of the Chinatown Neighborhood Board. Her concern is security on the streets. We asked her what she sees and what she'd like to see changed.
I think information and knowledge will help with bringing attention to this area, which we've been battling for many, many years. It hasn't improved. It's gotten worse because of the characters that surround that area. So it's that first block in Pauahi, Manakia, and River. And most of the problems started about 16 years ago when River of Life moved in. And they were feeding 30,000 meals a month, Monday to Friday, three meals a day. So you bring a lot of people with wood gum. But along with that, the city hasn't beefed up on security, like more police officers for that particular area. There's no security, private security provided by the entity that, you know, feed these people. They don't provide bathrooms. And so unless you're inside the building where you are receiving service or you sign up for showers, then you can use the inside facilities. Basically, they just hand a box of food out, and these folks just sit around and eat them and leave their trash along the sidewalk, and that came to a head. And then now they are all required to throw the empty trays, food trays and boxes into a trash bin. So it's a lot neater than before. And I recall several years ago, we have to make a weekend toilet in order to at least reduce the amount of feces and urine on our streets. So CBCA, which is my organization, it stands for Chinatown Business and Community Association. We scared up some money. It cost us $10,000 to implement the 90-day pilot public toilets to convince the city that we need public toilets. So 3 years ago, the Pauahi Hali was installed with the first Chinatown Hygiene Center, and they operate from 7 to 7 days a week, and that has helped a lot. And it's principally to cater to those working poor who live in the cars for the work, and also the bulk of the users are homeless people.
The area of a couple of people have commented since the attack a couple of weeks ago that the character of Chinatown changes those two or three blocks when you get close to River Street, the Eva end of Chinatown. Is that accurate?
Correct. From King, from Hotel, actually all the way from King, Nimitz, straight down to Kukui, is very blighted. When you just take that walk, it could have been such a beautiful walk. With our Nuanu River, and that was in the plans by Todd Development that it would be a green belt connecting the ocean to the mountain. But it is our most blighted street, covering Nimitz all the way down, and the sidewalks normally are blocked by shopping carts and tents, and folks are unable to walk on that side of the street anyway.
How long has this been an issue in with your organization and in your neighborhood?
Oh, forever. I mean, I think the best time that we didn't have this kind of problem were under Mayor Harris. After that, it's been kind of neglected. I mean, after Mayor Harris, there's a lot of talk about, oh, wanted to make Chinatown this and that. Nothing happens. I don't think the city really has a good plan. They are just reacting to certain things that happen, like the rail comes in, all of a sudden there's a TOD function, they want to do this and that, and they decided we should do complete streets in Chinatown, we should reduce vehicular traffic, let's make people ride the bicycle, let's make them more pedestrian friendly. Then they implemented this crazy stuff like overdue by not informing people, and they installed these bulbouts, which are covered amongst congested Panikir Street and Pauahi, and cars and traffic cannot turn, and then the delivery and trash pickup were blocked. Have you seen the bulbouts?
You're talking about the where the curb kind of sticks out into this.
Yeah, right. And then they stretch from 7 feet in width to 30 feet, 25 to 30 feet long. And that hole, when they painted it brown, that means you can step on it, and you have to pedestrian right away over there. But the traffic light is concentrated where you're crossing the street. So you have to walk back up to cross the street, so you're not helping you crossing any faster. And meantime, cars and large emergency vehicles have a hard time maneuvering, and then it blocks off the lay shops so people can just stop and go. It blocks off the Cha Hong Sat, the Manapur place. And then they just put a whole big bicycle rack in front of Lin's florist and block the view and block everything with a huge Mickey bike rack. And it really complicated things because the traditional use for that space is for emergency pullover, and then all of a sudden you don't have that.
Chulan,
and it creates a lot of mess in Chinatown. It didn't help.
Chulan, what would you like to see done in your community?
I think the city needs to talk to the people that live and work there. They just cannot say, oh, we have this idea, we're going to do it here, and we're going to experiment on you, because you are really, really affecting people's livelihood. Business went down 20 to 40%. since the pop out and less people coming to Chinatown, and that didn't help with the increased violence and robbery, purse snatching, violent assault and car theft, you know, breaking into vehicles, because there's an increased number of criminal homeless who are on crack cocaine, and they're very violent, including women, a couple of very violent women. And these are folks that were not in Chinatown several months ago.
So you're seeing the character of the community changing
and
for the worse.
Exactly, Chris, because the even though the point in day count of homeless decreased 9%, it's not true in Chinatown. And especially when they do periodic sweeps, they bring a lot of Kakaako people, Alam Alam Wharton people here, and Waikiki people here. And unless they come up with a plan to really make transitional housing, and either you call it a homeless tent park or call it whatever, it has to be secured with services, not only toilets, community kitchen, and a security guard, so that people are protected from within and without. You know, the people outside needs to be protected too.
Chulan Schubert Kwok is the president of the Chinatown Community and Business Association and a member of the Chinatown Neighborhood Board. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, contributing editor Neil Milner takes the long view on campaign ethics and the way they're policed. But first, your quiz. If you've been to the top, you know that this hike is not for the faint of heart. After climbing the 1,048 stairs and making it to the top of Koko Head, the crater's rich history is probably one of the last things on your mind. But the views and the crisp air on top make it worth it in the end. Koko Crater is one of the most popular landmarks on the south shore of Oahu. It's classified as a cinder cone and measures 1,208 feet in height. Even from a distance, one can see the hiking trail that leads to its peak. These stairs are actually railroad ties that once were part of the former Koko Crater radar station built by the U.S. Army in 1942. During the Second World War, the railway track was used to haul military personnel and supplies to bunkers at the top of Koko Crater. At the bottom was a base camp, with barracks and a mess hall, as well as buildings for equipment maintenance. What we want to know today is who took over the crater after the war was over and the Army left. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaiian Airlines, offering nonstop service to 12 North American cities, now including Long Beach. HawaiianAirlines.com.
Hawaii Public Radio is hiring. Are you looking for a part-time position in a lively and highly collaborative work environment? Do you have bookkeeping experience and a passion for detail? Then go to hawaiipublicradio.org for more details about our accounting assistant opening. Submit your application by June 30th.
Honolulu Civil Beat has won a round in a prolonged legal battle aimed at finding out how the Honolulu Police Department handled a 2014 case of an officer accused of assaulting his girlfriend. That assault was captured on video and triggered a number of calls for reform. But Sergeant Darren Cachola is back on the job, and the police officers' union, SHOPO, has sued to keep private the decision to restore him to duty. It's a tangled web, and Honolulu Civil Beat editor Patty Epler is on the line to untangle it for us. Good morning, Patty.
Good morning, Chris.
The sergeant was fired by HPD and restored to his job through arbitration. Is that right?
That's correct. And the Honolulu Police Department, under its relatively new chief, Susan Ballard, was poised to release the arbitration decision to give the public all the, you know, reasoning behind why that ruling was made. And the police union, as you pointed out, stepped in and filed suit to keep it secret. The union claims that officers have a right to privacy, more so than other public employees whose disciplinary records are always made available. And so Civil Beat has intervened in that case. We made a public records request to get the decision and were, you know, denied after the lawsuit was filed. So we've stepped in on the side of the city. Mm-hmm. So SHOPO is in essence fighting the city and Civil Beat on this case.
The underlying question, Patty, it sounds as if it's do police officers have a higher standard of their privacy protection than others, other individuals, other citizens, and other public employees, right?
That is what's at issue. And it's kind of interesting because the Hawaii Supreme Court has ruled several times now, going back to the 1990s, that police officers do not have what they call a constitutional right to privacy. And so, and what the Supreme Court has said, including in some police misconduct case that we brought a few years ago as well, you have to balance the public's interest against the officer's right to privacy, just as you do in every other sort of case where you want some information about someone. And, you know, we believe that this is a case of high public interest. You may remember that when Sergeant Cachola's, when the video first came out, people were just stunned by what was going on that tape. You know, it showed him sort of knocking this lady around throughout the restaurant over and over again. And it brought the Women's Legislative Caucus, you know, so lawmakers, domestic violence advocates, all going down to the police department to talk to then Chief Kealoha about what the heck was going on here, raised all sorts of issues.
No arrest, right, Patty?
Never arrested. Never charged. There were also, but he was fired. And then the arbitration has played out for a couple of years now. So
it'll be interesting to see where it goes.
Yeah, and I think there's still a very high level of interest in the case and how the police department handles domestic violence within its own ranks, let alone with citizen cases. So, you know, we're very interested in seeing what the arbitrator found that no one else saw.
Well, all you have to do is review that video, which is on your website. But thanks very much for that story, Patty.
Thank you, Chris. It was great to be with you.
That was Honolulu Civil Beat editor Patty Epler with today's Reality Check. And to read the full story, visit civilbeat.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Chaminade University, Inter Island Solar Supply, and Hastings and Pleadwell, a communication company.
We've seen some high-profile abuses of campaign spending laws in recent years, the most recent being congressional candidate Kaniella Ng's $15,000 fine for filing false reports about his campaign contributions and his expenditures. The Campaign Spending Commission took a relatively tolerant view, one member saying there are not enough good politicians. We asked contributing editor Neil Milner for the long view on Hawaii's campaign spending laws and the way they're enforced. Good morning, Neil.
Thanks. Good morning, Chris.
Now, the Campaign Spending Commission reviews the rules and has the option of making, in extreme cases, a recommendation to the prosecutor, right?
That's right. The Campaign Spending Commission really has a very broad amount, very detailed amount of stuff that it's supposed to be involved in and enforced. It looks at everything that's involved. So it is involved with the amount of money you can spend on a campaign, where it has to come from, what you use to give it to, and so on. And so what they can do then is they can take action in violation. And also, you have to report. You have these regular reports where you're supposed to give money regularly. Mm-hmm. And there is a way of doing this where you have to file by a certain date. If you're violating the rules, the Campaign Spending Commission has it in their discretion to punish you, fine you, as they did in Ng's case, mm-hmm. and they have the option, if they think it's proper, to refer it to a prosecutor's office, the attorney general or another prosecutor, for possible criminal charges.
Mm-hmm. In this case, 23 reports were filed. All of them were described as incorrect. They could also be described as false, right?
Yes. It's not much of an exaggeration to say that of everything that you're supposed to do when it comes to and what you're not supposed to do, Ng did not do what he was supposed to do regularly in terms of filing reports. He did certain things that go beyond what you'd say about using the money in certain ways, commingling campaign money with personal expenses, mm-hmm. over a period of years, and was a serial violator of reporting the things. He essentially never really reported the amount of money he was spending. So if you look at the charges and what the commission find, there's a whole series of itemized things, $500 here, $500 there, charged, and it adds up to $15,000.
Paying the rent.
But I mean, what the fines were, it's like a grocery list of different violations, mm-hmm. that add up to $15,000 fine. And that's where it stopped in this case.
So what do you have to do to get in trouble around here?
Well, the legal answer is that the commission is supposed, if they think that it's a serious violation, they can move it forward for possible criminal charges. But they also have the discretion not to see it that way. And the majority of the commission decided that they didn't want to hurt this guy's political career. There are not enough good politicians around, which I certainly agree. There are never enough good politicians around. So it stopped there.
Is it in their kuleana, Neil, to decide who's a good politician and who ain't?
Well, that's an interesting question. On the one hand, at a kind of abstract level, they have the discretion, right? They mm-hmm. don't have but on the other hand, there is a series of criteria that you can read that's in the statutes that says under what circumstances could they, not they, they have to move it forward.
Yeah.
And one of them is recklessness. It isn't just willful violation. So what you had here is a whole series of lots of things that went wrong. Even if you wanted to give Ng the benefit of the doubt that they weren't willful or something like willful, where the charges would be higher, there certainly seemed to be a case here that this was reckless behavior. I think that the representative, Ng, tried to make a distinction between recklessness and cluelessness, because a lot of his own defense, which we can get to in more detail in a second, is about that. So the answer is they didn't have to. Prima facie, it seemed to me that there's a pretty good case at least to go to the prosecutor's office, and at least one of those commissioners said, we don't want to do that. It might ruin his life. He's a young guy. We don't want to put him too much in debt, and his heart is in the right place.
Well, so are a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, his defense, the last thing, if you read the formal report, is Ng's response to this. And his response is interesting. Some of it is, here's the response as far as I can see is what I call the Officer Krupke response.
Uh-huh.
If you remember from West Side Story, there's a song about Officer Krupke, the police officer who's trying to go after the gang, and the gang goes through all of this kind of stuff about, don't punish us, that would be bad, you know, don't follow the law. And the big line is, I'm depraved on a kind of I'm deprived. And one of the arguments that Ng makes in there is, I can't afford paying this fine because I don't have any money now. I have a young family and I have student loans, which to me is not an argument that, say, the average criminal is able to make as a means of mitigating circumstances. Now, you understand, this is not a, this is before an administrative agency.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's not making this before a court to say, don't punish me as much. This is an administrative agency who could have decided that that argument isn't so good. Let them go to criminal court and decide. But they basically buy it. He has all kinds of reasons why. And then he admits that he made a mistake. You're supposed to have a campaign treasurer.
Mm-hmm.
And that campaign treasurer disappeared. And so essentially that made it harder. It makes it harder in an administrative sense to decide whom you contact if you're on the commission. So that's where it is. That's where it ends. And the consequences that he may or may not face really are how well he's going to do. Ng is running for the first congressional district seat. How well he's going to do and how much it's going to affect him. He hasn't gotten good press out of this at all. The press has been pretty critical of Ng of this.
Well, failing to disclose more than $87,000 in expenditures are about 62. I'm just reading off the 62% of the total amount of spending reflected in his bank statements. Is there precedent for this? Have we seen cases like this before?
Oh, there have been cases here and there where this kind of thing. I don't remember a case where you have cases lots of times where there's some kind of commingling of funds, a legislator on the
late reports
all the time.
Yeah.
You had the mayor of Maui arguing with the campaign spending commission about whether he could give money to campaign funds to charities and so on. You know, when you have all of these rules and you have politicians who essentially want to figure out a way around it, not necessarily because they're malicious, but because they need the money, mm-hmm. you're going to have this kind of back and forth all the time. What is impressive in a kind of bad sort of way about Ng's case is how long it went on, how repetitive the violations were, even when he knew there were violations, and ultimately the size of it. And it's not just one kind of thing. It's not just failure to report. Now, you can, you know, if you want to buy the argument that, you know, look, teacher, I didn't do my homework. It's the last day of the semester, and I'm throwing myself at the mercy of whoever. That's what.
But it also raises a question, Neil, about the role of a watchdog agency. Is it a watchdog or a cheerleader?
That's exactly right. And a watchdog agency, an administrative agency, is always going to have some kind of discretion. That's what you set them up for. That's what the administrative agency is supposed to do. But you also assume that there are certain kind of rules that under certain circumstances they will kick in. And in this case, they didn't violate anything. They chose not to use what was clearly within their power to do so.
We're going to be hearing more about this, I'm sure. Thanks a
lot. Oh, yeah. You're welcome.
Political analyst Neil Milner taught political science at UH Manoa for 40 years and is the contributing editor of our segment, The Long View.
This week, the nation was transfixed in horror as a woman was asked to leave a restaurant after receiving a free cheese plate. At long last, sir, have you no wine pairing? I'm Peter Sagal. We don't refuse service to anyone, even if they want us to. Join us as we talk to oceanographer Fabienne Cousteau on this week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the news quiz from NPR.
Saturday morning at 11.
Part of East Oahu's tropical charm includes the grueling hike we know as Cocoa Head. If you've done the hike, you know it lives up to its reputation as a challenge with its steep stairs and sharp incline. At about halfway, there's a bridge spanning a 10 to 15-foot gully. Those who are squeamish about heights may prefer the trail to the right that bypasses the gully, but the views at the top are well worth the effort. Your reward for the pain is a breathtaking 360-degree view of East Oahu, including Hawaii Kai and Diamond Head. On clear days, the mountains of Molokai, Maui, and Lanai can be seen in the distance. Many don't know that these stairs are actually railroad ties that were once part of the former Koko Crater radar station built by the U.S. Army in 1942. After the war, the facility was taken over by 169th Aircraft Control and Warning Squadron of the Hawaii Air National Guard. Well, nobody knew that today, but tomorrow is another day, or Monday, I should say. And that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, providing opportunities for students' summer reading with Achieve 3000 Hawaii Home Access, wishing students, parents, teachers, and administrators an enjoyable summer. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
For 34 years, Maui's Pacific Primate Sanctuary has been home to monkeys, marmosets, and tamarin monkeys that are not native to the islands. Many of them have been kept in cages and will live out their lives here in Hawaii. Catherine Cruz visited the facility in upcountry Maui to understand its place in the community. She talked with Lucy Wormser, who established the facility in Haikou, which is permitted by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
The animals are given green environments. When they come here, many of them never saw the sky, and they never saw green life. They lived in environments where they were not able to be who they are.
So many of these monkeys came from laboratories?
Many came from laboratories. Some were pets in people's homes. Some were at tourist attractions. Most of the monkeys that we have are from the Amazon rainforest. They wound up in laboratories through no fault of their own. And when the laboratories stopped the study, they couldn't just euthanize them as they do with 100,000 primates a year. They had to be sent somewhere because many of them are on the endangered species list.
They aren't allowed to kill these monkeys after they do their experiment.
Legally, they're not allowed because of some USDI regulations. So they try to find a place, and then sometimes we have to provide the shipping crates. And we had a very bad experience, the last one, from a laboratory in the Midwest, which sent two endangered cotton-top tamarins. And between L.A. and Honolulu, the animals died. And that's made it very difficult for us to bring, in the past 3 years, for us to bring any more animals in. It's been terribly painful to think of that, to get a call from quarantine in Honolulu that the two monkeys in the cage are laying on the ground with blood coming out of their mouths. And there was nothing that the airline addressed, despite the fact that the USDA and a lot of people were trying to find out what had happened. So there isn't a clean, direct route here as there used to be.
And so these monkeys come in by air?
Yes, they come. I used to use the PetSafe program, which we had to pay extra for, which supposedly ensured they're being carried, hand-carried. But despite that, they didn't make it from L.A. to Honolulu.
So you put a pause on that?
It weighs heavily on all of us that happened. But we have young volunteers who have come from all over the world, and some of them are inspired to try again, to contact the labs and let them know we're accepting animals. We have space.
What's the count up to now?
There are 40 animals there. They're mostly tamarins and marmosets, who are the small arboreal. They live high in the trees, little monkeys from the rainforest. And that's the sounds that you hear, are those high, wonderful sounds that they communicate with each other and tell each other where they are, what they're eating, if there's a hawk overhead, if it's raining. And some of their sounds are just amazing music. Galatea, one of the saddleback tamarins who came from a laboratory, sings. I mean, her sounds are extraordinary. And she's old. She's 22. She's been living here for 10 years. And in all of the textbooks, the oldest that marmosets and tamarins get is 15 years old, and she's 21. So we have to specialize their diets, and a lot of them are geriatric at this point. So they need to be kept warm, and they need special diets. And most of our interns and volunteers have been trained in emergency care and in advanced emergency care. We have a wonderful veterinarian in Makawao named Dr. Butler, who's been incredible researching and going out of his way to make it possible to give support to the animals as they age. But to see them come from a space where they aren't even in their own body, so to speak, and where they become who they were meant to be, has been the greatest experience of my life, and I think it's what touches all the volunteers.
And you have a pretty incredible volunteer program set up where they actually live here at the facility and so really get to understand the animals.
It's a resident program, and people come from all over the world. It's become kind of a competitive program. So we have people on the waiting list. But we select people who have experience caring for exotics, but we teach them how to care for exotic animals from the very beginning and how to even manage a sanctuary at the end, if that's what they choose, if they choose to stay extra. And the community, the Pacific Primate Sanctuary community, is a community of hearts. Nobody's doing it for money or to get prestige. It's all about aloha aina. It's about the values that are here in our native land. And those values are really part of what make the sanctuary amazing. The view of an animal as a sentient being, as a being who's like us, as equal, is a unique idea in our time, even at this point, when we've been through racism and sexism already, and they have names now. And we've never dealt with speciesism, which is the belief that our species is superior to every other being on the planet, which allows us to exploit everything on the earth, and which in the end may leave us just with humans and cockroaches, because I don't think the environment can survive with the attitude that it's all here for the taking and you don't have to give anything back.
So the monkeys are your way of giving.
The monkeys are my way of being able to look in the mirror in the morning and have my breakfast. So if I'm using resources from the earth, I have to give back to the earth, which is also a Hawaiian concept.
You mentioned the special diet. What do they eat?
Well, we grow an organic vegetable garden, the interns do, and it's splendid. It has, thanks to Alan Arakawa last year, he gave us some funds to be able to expand our garden, and it's producing amazing amount of vegetables. We have a huge fruit orchard, so all through the year there's fresh, organically grown fruits and vegetables, which are carefully cut up and prepared, along with a balanced diet for the species that we have, which we we purchase and is sent to us.
Okay, yeah, I was wondering about that. If it was special foods that maybe they had where they're from originally that we don't have here.
Many of the plants that they would be exposed to in their natural environments, relatives of those plants do grow here. As a matter of fact, some of the marmosets are gummivorous. They go on the tree and make a little rectangular hole. They have special teeth to do that. And then an exudate comes out of the tree, which is like a gooey, clear, sweet.
Like a sap.
It's actually the tree's Band-Aid. It's the tree trying to fix the rectangular hole. And the marmosets will live on that in the months that there's no fruit and vegetables in the wild, or fruits. They wouldn't be eating vegetables, right. But plant material.
But they now have it year-round.
Well, we planted some of those gum trees that were grown here in Hawaii, actually. And the food that they eat has all of the nutrition. Missouri is the company that we buy the food from. It's a balanced diet, so they're getting everything they need aside from fruits and vegetables that we grow.
So essentially, though, you are licensed by the USDA and their regulations about, you know, their care. You're particular about, you know, making sure that, you know, they don't get exposed to things that could threaten their health.
I wrote some of those regulations that are in the Animal Welfare Act. I was approached to describe how to care for the marmosets and tamarins. I don't think the USDA helps us, really. Mm-hmm. It's a licensing agency that we pay money to. But we've learned how to provide expert care on our own, and we've really become primatologists over 30 years of learning what they need to fulfill their own lives and be able to use their bodies. For example, the two spider monkeys up there never brachiated, and that's the way they move in the forest, which is hand over hand. And they never had an enclosure that was long enough to move their bodies in the way that they were built to move their bodies. And so we built a 40-foot long enclosure planted with trees and flowers and vines. And the first time we saw Carlos put his hand up and realize he could put his next hand up, and suddenly he was moving like he was meant to move. It's chicken skin.
That was Lucy Wormser of Maui's Pacific Primate Sanctuary talking about what inspired her to found the center. The facility, which is not open to the public, is located in Haikou, and it survives by donations and volunteers. To learn more, you can find links on our webpage at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, where the focus is on science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Proud to be a sponsor of HPR's First Take with Science Friday with Ira Flato. SacredHearts.org.
Some of the activities going on around the state come in a little bit under the radar, and that's where we rely on Morning Edition host and our colleague Derek Malama for a look at some of those events. Good morning, Derek.
Good morning, Chris.
Well, tomorrow people can learn how to actually take pictures with those cell phones.
Yes, it's
around.
An art, from what I've found out.
So I'm told.
Yes. Glenn Nishida will share a basic composition, apps, and techniques to get the most from your cell phone camera. His work has been published widely in the New York Times and Huffington Post. This workshop is tomorrow from 2 to 3:30 in the Waianae Public Library.
And what do you get when you mix art and nature on Maui?
The Wahipana Awahi Art Show in Makawao. That's happening tomorrow. This exhibit features works by Maui artists highlighting the restoration of a native forest. The opening will feature a special performance by Paula Funga, along with a hula halau and family-oriented activities. This free event is from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. tomorrow, at Hui Noiau Visual Arts Center in Makaua'u.
And if you're on the Big Island and you love tigers, you can head to Hilo tomorrow.
It's Tiger Fun Day, that's why, at the Panaeva Zoo. You'll have games and prizes for the keiki, plus food and entertainment. And new this year are zoo passports. Collect all the required stickers, and you'll receive a prize. There's free parking and a shuttle from the equestrian center parking lot to the Panaeva Zoo. A Tiger Fun Day is from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. tomorrow in Hilo.
Sounds good, Derek. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community that might be going on under the radar. You can always find out more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Bush Consulting, Sacred Hearts Academy, and Urgent Care Hawaii.
Modern whales rule the sea, but did you know about their early ancestors, dog-like animals that roamed the land? I'm Ira Plato. On the next Science Friday, we'll track the evolution of these majestic mammals through whale fossils scattered in the desert and tagging expeditions in the Antarctic, plus how genetic testing is reshaping the bull market for beef ranchers. It's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon from 1 to 3.
And that's it for this week. Coming up next week, my co-host Catherine Cruz will be back, and Science Friday's Ira Flato will visit our studio and take your questions. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave your comments at 808-792-8217. Email is talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation. Tweet us at HI Conversation. You can also find us on Instagram at The Conversation HPR. If you want to hear today's show again, get another past show, or links to more information, go to The Conversation page on the HPR website, hawaiipublicradio.org. The program is produced by Lillian Song, Ryan Finity, and Amber Khan Grusby. Our intern is Harrison Patino. The Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us on Monday.